Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Baby, I'll give it to you.
That was really good.
Yes, it does. It's dead on.
Okay, keep the chatter down in this room.
Are you ready to begin?
Yes, I'm all set, yeah.
Welcome to the December 2020 edition of Space Boffins in partnership with the Naked Scientists, and it is a good one. I'm Richard Hollingham.
Does that mean the previous ones are not so good? I think you maybe need to rethink that.
No, they're good. This is really good.
This is especially good.
This is a good one.
This is a really, really good
one. They're good, obviously.
This
is an excellent one.
Thank you. That's better. That's better. I'm Sue Nelson.
Although I'm worried now.
Yeah, exactly. Sort of thing. In a moment, we'll be hearing from British ESA astronaut Tim Peake about his perilous docking with the space station, a bumpy return to Earth, space playlists, and the legacy of his six-month mission. And we'll also be talking to the authors of two rather excellent space-related books, one of which involves the joys of wearing Lycra cartoon style.
Now, unbelievably, it's 5 years since Tim Peake's launch in a Soyuz spacecraft to the International Space Station. Well, let's hear some of that marvellous European Space Agency commentary. I may be biased.
A second service tower separation.
The launch of Soyuz carrying ESA astronaut Tim Peake on his Principia mission to the International Space Station. On board the Soyuz spacecraft, Tim Peake in the left-hand seat, Yuri Malenchenko, Soyuz commander, in the centre seat, Tim Kopra, flight engineer for NASA, in the right-hand seat. Actually, that's not my best bit of commentary. My best bit of commentary was the 45 minutes where all you saw was astronauts' bottoms bobbing up and down, waiting for the hatch to open.
But that's
and
the sort of thing you put on your CV.
Come into the space station.
That's the sort of thing that's a CV want thing, because that's they're the most difficult things to do. Having when I first worked on BBC News 24, when it was the first digital 24-hour news program in the UK, wasn't it? And I spent a lot of my time, because it was quite new digital technology, talking when there was just a frozen flag on the screen, or having somebody in my ear saying, "Oh my God, we can't cope. Oh, and you're hearing what's going on in the director's room, and they're just going, keep talking. So yeah, I feel your pain with that. But what I loved about hearing you say that was that it takes me back to, and I'm sure we may have mentioned this before, actually, probably 5 years ago after the launch, was that I was sitting in a TV studio for some BBC morning programme commentating on the launch. And then they said, "And now we'll go to the launch commentary." And I heard your voice. And luckily the cameras weren't on me, because if they would have been, they would have seen me go to look all excited, but I couldn't say anything. That's Richard. But it was, that was so cool on so many levels, seeing a British ESA astronaut go up and also hearing your voice. That was rather special.
Oh, thank you. Now, 5 years on, Tim has an autobiography out, Limitless, you would have doubtless seen in all bookshops. And the UK Space Agency has launched a campaign encouraging people to submit their stories of how his 2015 Principia mission inspired them. Well, thanks to our support from the UK Space Agency, I was lucky enough to sit down with Tim for a half-hour chat during a special event at the ESA Centre in Harwell, Oxfordshire last week. And we're going to play you the whole of that wide-ranging conversation. Before he became an astronaut, though, Tim was a test pilot, and we began by talking about the significance to him of the ultimate test pilot, Chuck Yeager, who died this month.
Chuck Yeager was a huge icon, yeah, huge inspiration. Yes, to me as a test pilot, yes, growing up as somebody who was passionate about aviation, but I think also to so many people, because even if, you know, aviation wasn't your thing, the fact that that was an incredible human achievement, you know, we went faster than the speed of sound, and it was all part of progression and technology and pushing the boundaries. And really, Chuck Yeager just, you know, is the epitome of the right stuff and what it takes to push the boundaries.
Do you think that idea of the right stuff is still with us? I mean, you know, we've now got the TV series, The Right Stuff. We've had the book, we've had the film, this idea of the right stuff. Or is it more nuanced now?
It is more nuanced. I think the right stuff is interesting. It's changed over the years. What is the right stuff? And the right stuff now, I think, is more of a team, of more of a partnership. In the early days of Apollo and Gemini, Mercury, and you know, it was about taking fast jet test pilots and working as individuals, really, pushing machines to the limit. Now what we're doing, it's about collaboration, cooperation, teamwork. We're spending 6 months, 1 year in space. We're looking at going to the moon, going to Mars. We need a really diverse team that can handle all the different challenges that are going to be thrown up by those missions. So the right stuff has changed over the years.
It's interesting you mentioned that, because in the book, where you talk about your astronaut selection, you have a realization that what they're after is essentially, without saying it in so many words, a team player, someone who can live in a tin can around the Earth with other people without causing trouble.
Absolutely. I mean, on the astronaut selection, we spent 1 day doing the hard skills. So I would say that's concentration and memory retention, spatial awareness, a bit of science and engineering. 1 day. The remainder of the year was spent doing psychological profiling, soft skills, teamwork, leadership, communication. So that tells you exactly what the space agencies were really focusing on.
That is interesting. Now, I've got an apology to make to you. As you may or may not know, I did the commentary for ESA for your launch. I was at Munich at ColCC. And I actually sent you an email just before your launch, very critical of your music selections. And then when you were in the capsule just before launch, they played Europe, the Final Countdown. And I thought, that affirms my views. But you didn't actually, I read in your book, you didn't actually select that as a track.
No, that was a surprise to all of us. It was funny, you know, there was Yuri, Tim Cooper and myself all looking at each other saying, who put this on? You know, but it was funny because Costa, our Russian instructor, that was his choice, and he thought that would be the nice song to listen to as the final one. What really took us by surprise, though, is it finished and we were all kind of giggling about it, and we were 3 minutes from launch, and we had no idea that they would play the music up, you know, that late to launch.
That shows the confidence, doesn't it, in the Soyuz and the way that they do this, that the way they know it's going to work.
Yeah, it does. And obviously part of that is to try and relax the crew. But you're right, there's a huge amount of confidence in that spacecraft and in that rocket. And they have a mantra of, if ain't broke, then don't fix it. When you're sat in there, you're surrounded by components that haven't changed since the 60s. Yes, part of it is glass cockpit, and there's been parts that have been modernized. But essentially, it's a very old school rocket.
Is it also, do you think, just to stop you just thinking about your situation too much, to just kind of normalize it, I suppose?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, you have to get into the right mindset. And I think that mindset shift happens when the hatch is closed and you realize, okay, it's a very claustrophobic, very confined environment, but you embrace it. That's the new normal. You've taken your last breaths of fresh air for 6 months. And the music helps you relax. It helps you to normalize that situation. But you're very aware that you're sat on top of 300 tons of rocket fuel.
You're also incredibly cramped in those seats and with the pressure suit. Once you've lifted off and once you hit weightlessness, I mean, after that 8 minutes, is there an enormous feeling of kind of release and relief?
It is, yeah, because everything's designed for space. It's not designed for Earth, so we can't really walk properly in those spacesuits. You see us coming out and we're all stooped over. That's because the spacesuits are designed for a sitting position. If you were relaxed standing up, it would be far too baggy when you were sat down, and if it had to inflate, you'd be like the Michelin Man, all blown up and too much material. So that's why everything is designed for space, and it's uncomfortable until you get into space, and then you're in weightlessness, and that's when you realise that everything has been perfectly designed.
Is there a moment? I mean, you see it on the TV screen. And I can't remember what the cuddly toy was. Was it a giraffe or something?
Yuri actually had a pen, one of his daughter's pens as a mascot. But yeah, it tends to be a cuddly toy.
Some sort of cuddly toy that suddenly floats around.
Yeah. Yeah, along with any sort of tools that have been left behind by the crews. Any dust or debris or screws and things. So, no, there's not usually too many surprises. But, yeah, anything that's not strapped down will be floating as soon as you get into orbit.
So were there any stray bolts or...
We had a couple of little bits float up, which is funny. You know, you get that in aircraft sometimes when you're doing zero-G manoeuvres as well.
That's a bit alarming, isn't it? Because, you know, you build an IKEA flat pack and there's a couple of screws left over. You build a spacecraft, there's a couple of screws left over.
Yeah, I mean, obviously everything is designed and manufactured and tested in a very, you know, sterile environment. But at the end of the day, you're having a lot of people getting in that spacecraft in the last few days, being packed up with cargo. And so some stray bits do get in there.
Now, everything as ever, you know, we're talking about the launch and coming up to the docking, all so smooth, because it's always so smooth. And then can you just talk us through what happened with the docking? Because there was, I mean, suddenly there was, you know, and I say, I was at ColCC, so the mission control in Germany, not so many people there, not the main mission control. Nevertheless, suddenly the atmosphere just changed like that when you appeared to have to abort the docking at the ISS.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You know, in my years of aviation, you come to realise that the most dangerous situations are where it's not one failure, it's multiple failures. And we had already had this niggling failure going on in the Soyuz from the moment we got into orbit. And it was just a high humidity, and we had to manually remove the condensate from the spacecraft. So I was doing that, but it is an alarm and it comes on. And I was doing that probably about every 20 minutes. But of course, you then get desensitised to the master alarm. And here we go again, pump the condensate. And sure enough, as we were coming in for the docking, there was a condensate problem, but it was preceded by a fraction of a second by a thruster sensor failing. And that was the serious failure that caused us to abort. But what we saw on the screen was condensate. So here we go again, start pumping condensate, and we're still, you know, docking. And then we realized the spacecraft was moving backwards. We've aborted. And then there was a little bit of digging down, finding out what's gone wrong. Yuri had to take manual control and then fly the spacecraft manually, which turned out to be extremely difficult because we were transitioning between day to night. And as you cross the terminator, you know, you come into the shadow of the Earth, but also the sun, of course, is very, very low on the horizon. So the space station just becomes a complete mirror, reflecting all the light back. So Yuri was blinded by this light through all the optics. And I come back to the multiple failure scenario. Then a screen went down on us inside the spacecraft as well. So now we've got, you know, failure stacking up on top of them. So the first manual docking was not perfect at all, and we came to, you know, almost near collision scenario. So Yuri was able to recognize that, thankfully. He's a very experienced cosmonaut, backed off and lined it all up and came in for a textbook docking, but it was a bit shaky for a few moments there.
And there's that's your test pilot in you, isn't it? There, you also look and you picture the space station. There's so much now with the solar arrays and so many different modules. I mean, it's not even an easy approach, even in perfect conditions.
No, it's not. We were coming up from underneath the space station, and we had a Cygnus spacecraft that was already docked right next to us. Space station's a busy place. It's fun. It makes it exciting. But you're right, you could have a couple of progress vehicles, a Soyuz at the end in the Russian segment. You might have a Cygnus, a SpaceX now, or a Japanese HTV. So there are spacecraft coming and going, and the docking ports, you haven't got many meters between them, very few, in fact.
And what's interesting, it's ultimately when you have, like you said, the multiple failures, it comes down to the crew in the end. There's nothing mission control can do other than advise. You're the ones there that have to sort it out.
Yes, yeah. And in some respects, it's actually better to leave it to the crew to sort it out, because, you know, they're in the best place to be able to analyse what's gone wrong and to deal with it. As we get more data coming back from spacecraft, it's a case of, you know, getting that balance right between what data is going to mission control and where they can help and where they can inform, versus, you know, the bells and whistles that's going on inside a spacecraft and what needs to happen at the right the right time. And it's interesting. It's always one of my favourite movies is Apollo 13. And you see,
mine too. You know, it's literally my favourite film.
Yeah, and you see that, you know, and we, you know, we hear that on the voice transcripts of you know, Mission Control trying to analyse this data in a very sterile environment, and actually up in space, you've got a spacecraft that's spinning out of control, and you know, and they're dealing with something very physical, very real that's gone wrong with this shimmy going on, and Mission Control is thinking it's just a telemetry problem.
What I love, though, and it did take quite a while, once you docked, for finally you come into the ISS, it's like it's all over. And what was that first impression of the space station? Because obviously you've trained in the full-size simulator, but in gravity. Yeah. Was anything strange? Was anything the wrong way up, or was it how you expected it?
It is strange. It does take your brain a while to work it all out. But the strange thing is that it feels very, very familiar. It's a home from home, because you've trained in these very high fidelity mock-ups all around the world. And so coming into the Russian Mimadin is where we dock to, you think, oh, hang on, this is just like Star City, and but I'm floating. And then there are a few differences, but really not many. I mean, we keep the mock-ups here on Earth at a very high level so that we can train properly. The biggest shock, of course, is going into the cupola window, and that's when you get this incredible view, and you think, okay, this is not like the, you know, Johnson Space Center.
Well, let's talk about, you know, life on the space station. I was lucky enough to be at Marshall, NASA Marshall, when you were on the station, and they kept talking about the Tims, and the because it was you and Tim Copra. And they kept saying, the Tims are fantastic. They're way ahead of their timeline. I mean, were you aware that you were referred to as the Tims?
No.
As a collective?
We weren't, no. But it was interesting. We did have a few discussions before going up when they said, what would you like to be called? And we kind of looked at each other and said, well, Tim. You know, Tim. Yeah, I think that will work fine. And they kind of looked a bit perplexed, said, but surely we need to call you something different. So we said, well, if there is any ambiguity, then just Tim Peake, Tim Copra. But actually, the majority of the time, it worked out fine. And we were just the Tims.
But you did seem to work together really well as a team, particularly the two of you.
Yeah, we did. I was very fortunate, really, and very grateful to be crewed with Tim Copra, very like-minded. You know, we'd shared similar careers. He was a US Apache pilot, and I'd been obviously a British Apache pilot, having served time with the US as well. So we had lots in common, and I think we had a similar approach to the way we dealt with situations. I mean, Tim is great. He's very thoughtful, considerate, and cool and calm, and he just takes everything in his stride. I like that kind of approach. That suits my personality and character.
I was going to say, would you describe yourself as that?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I don't tend to get fazed by things, and I think, you know, taking a cool, calm approach to situations is always better than jumping in and coming to the wrong conclusion. And Scott Kelly was a fantastic commander when we first arrived. You know, Scott had been on board 8 months. He had the space station running like clockwork. I mean, it was just incredible to see him work. So we were really fortunate to take over a space station which was in absolute top order.
Was he quite an intimidating character to be as your commander, particularly he'd been there for 8 months? I mean, I've interviewed him, and I'm like when I've interviewed some of the Apollo astronauts, I'm a little bit scared, if truth be told.
Yeah, Scott is one of these people who, you know, he comes across as quite intimidating, quite gruff, very, you know, short, and to the point. And he is, but actually when you get to know him, he's brilliant. He's got a fantastic sense of humour. He's a wonderful leader, and he's very caring and considerate. And caring and considerate would not be the first two adjectives you would probably describe him, having met him for 5 minutes, you know. But he is. He's a very selfless leader. And on multiple occasions on the space station, you know, he would put himself out to help out the crew. So he was a brilliant person to have up there as the commander.
Now, obviously you did the work you were assigned, the ESA work, but you did a lot of outreach work. Were you aware that, you know, you were becoming, particularly in the classrooms around the UK, a bit of a superstar? You know, it wasn't maybe a national celebrity, but it was certainly a celebrity among among children in classrooms.
It's something you're really unaware of, actually. In space, you're quite isolated up there, cut off, and everything is one way. I think the thing about, and I guess this is a testament to how well we run things on the space station, because everything appears as if it's two-way, but it's not. It's kind of, we're recording things in space, sending things down, and we will then get on to work, and very rarely do we then see the feedback. So lots of the messages I'd be sending would be all just recorded and sent down. So you're very unaware of the impact that the mission is having until you actually get back down. And when we sat with the UK Space Agency before the mission, we came up with this plan. I don't think any of us realised the impact it was going to have. We came up with about 30 projects and probably thought, well, if half of this is taken on and if half of this is successful, then we'll call that a good job done. And the fact that every single program kind of grew a life of its own, and you know, the schools really engaged, the teachers really engaged, and the students really engaged, it was unbelievable. But I didn't see a lot of that until I got back and then realised the impact the mission had had.
Do you feel that we're seeing that, you know, the benefits of that now?
Very much so, yeah. And I think that, you know, so many people are inspired. Yes, it was the younger people in particular, when we have, you know, somebody in space and you can use space as part of the curriculum to then get people engaged in science and tech and maths, then it's a wonderful platform to use. So space is also a place of wonder and excitement and awe. And so young children tend to be in that imaginative phase where they get really excited about it. But I had lots of, you know, mature people and some elderly people as well saying that they were just like little kids again, you know, back to getting engaged in space, going out to their gardens to look at the space station. So I think space is a place of inspiration for all. But you are right. I mean, it was, the program was focused on inspiring the next generation.
But it's extraordinary that we should even become jaded about this, isn't it? Because, you know, you look at that, you talk about the pictures from the cupola, or the fact you can stand out in the garden, well, probably not today, but, you know, and see the space station go over. I mean, that is inspiring.
It's hugely inspiring, absolutely. And it goes to show what we can achieve when we work together. And the fact that we have created something like that, you know, and left our planet, and we've occupied it for over 20 years. We've had humans in space. So, that, you know, it's interesting when you go around and talk to children and students and you say for the entirety of your life, not all the human population has been on Earth as long as you've been alive. You know, at least some people have always been in space. That's quite incredible.
Yeah, that absolutely is. With your, I mean, downtime on the space station, I know you filled it with a lot of these sorts of experiments, but was there time to take stock, or was, because I've, you know, I've spoken to quite a few astronauts, and often they say, I didn't really kind of hit home until I was back on the Earth of what I was going through or experiencing. And I think I picked up some of that in the book, because I've interviewed you before about your spacewalk, and now when you write about it 5 years on, You're almost much more poetic. I think you've got a bit more of an Italian in you with the spacewalk now than you did when I first interviewed you about it maybe four years ago. And is that a process? Have you found that?
It's very much a process, yeah. And you do make time to, you know, relax on the space station. You do have to make time to enjoy and to reflect to a degree. But you're always working at a high tempo. You're always keeping that edge on the space station in case something goes wrong. You're always aware that you're in a hostile environment and you need to be prepared for any eventuality. So I think that environment stops you from completely relaxing and processing your thoughts and emotions. So I think you kind of do keep things in check. And then gradually over the years, you're able to kind of go back and reflect. Only last summer, I was at a dinner with Rusty Schreikart and speaking about his, you know, spacewalk. And he was saying the same thing. He said, I don't think I've processed that spacewalk completely, you know, even now after all the years. So it's something that you do, I think, process to a much larger degree once you get back. You have time to reflect.
Now, can I just talk about your return to Earth? I know that, you know, you did the smiles for the cameras when you got out of the capsule. And afterwards, you weren't very well at all immediately afterwards. And I didn't really realise, again, until I've read in your book, what actually happened. So can you sort of explain what about the re-entry and then the physical consequences of all that.
Yeah, so I mean, actually, I mean, the re-entry was brilliant fun, and I loved it. I've got the GoPro footage, and I've watched it a few times, and I'm just saying, giggling like a schoolboy as we're pulling the G's and the wrapped in a ball of plasma, and the parachutes come open. It's a roller coaster ride. That's all enormous fun. As actually is the landing as well. Yes, it's a car crash, but it's quite an event, and you feel fine. There's no kind of feeling of sickness or anything. And then you're waiting for about 10 minutes for the search and rescue crews to come and find you and get you out of the spacecraft. And that's when gravity starts taking its toll. And your whole vestibular system is really not comfortable, and it affects people to a varying degree. I mean, I was very, very lucky going into space. I had virtually no space sickness and got straight on with it. And some people suffer for 10 days with space sickness, but then some people come back to Earth and they're absolutely fine. I was somebody who had 2 days of feeling pretty dreadful, just I think as my vestibular system sorted itself out as you come back to gravity. So your balance is a bit off, but it's this sort of feeling of dizziness and nausea. And that's the worst feeling. You just don't want to move your head. You can imagine what it's like if you move your head and the world spins. So, that was the most unpleasant thing.
And you couldn't urinate.
Well, what was funny is, we wear nappies in the spacecraft on launch, re-entry and during a spacewalk, because you've got no access to a loo for hours and hours at a time. And it's important to stay hydrated as well during those periods. And I hadn't actually needed to use it at all on launch or during the spacewalk. And then for re-entry, another thing we do is we try and fluid load before we come back. We actually have salt tablets, and the salt tablets, depending on your body weight, you have a fixed amount of salt and then you drink the liquid to go with it. And the idea is to try and bulk up your body fluid, because in space, what you've done over 6 months is you've lost a lot of body fluid because you just don't need it. And when you come back to Earth, if you haven't got it, then that can, make your blood pressure drop quite low, and it can cause fainting, for example. So, you're supposed to drink water and salt load, which I had, but then we wear these kentavas as well, which are like Russian garments. They're like anti-G suits, but they don't actually inflate like a...
So they're constrictive.
They just constrict, with laces. So you wear them tightly. And I guess I probably, I drunk my fluid wearing this kentava, but didn't need to urinate at all during re-entry. For absolutely fine, no problems at all. When you come off the spacecraft, you go into the medical tent, and they'll often put an IV drip in you again to try and get fluid inside you. So I had that as well. And it was only as we were on the helicopter and we were on this MI-17 and we were going to the airport where the NASA jet was waiting for us. And I said to my medical surgeon, I said, look, I've got a bit of stomach pain and I'm not sure why or what it is. So there in the back of the helicopter, he just got the ultrasound and had a quick look, and he just laughed and he said, your bladder is the size of a rugby ball. He said, I'm not surprised you've got some stomach pain. You need to urinate. Like, oh, that's weird, because I don't feel like I need to, but okay. And then when I got back to the, we got into the medical room, and I couldn't. My bladder had distended. It had gone so far that it actually then stops you from urinating. And this is a problem that's happened with astronauts before. And, of course, the only way to do that is to have a catheter so you can actually release the pressure and urinate. So I had all this going on as well, which is not the most pleasant of things to deal with when your world is also without returning and your world is spinning around as well. But it was fine. I mean, it's a very basic procedure at the end of the day.
So looking back now, 5 years, that flight to the space station, does it feel like that?
Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it feels just like yesterday. It's incredible. And then, sometimes I think, gosh, yeah, wow, 5 years. It's how the time flies. But it's amazing to think back, to that whole experience. And, it's something that will stay with me forever, very fresh in my mind, thankfully.
And you've done a lot. You've obviously got the book out now, but you've done work with scouts, with schools, with, and continuing what you were doing in space. Has that been important?
Yeah, very much so. You know, we've had this brilliant outreach campaign, and it was important to keep that going, to keep the inspiration going. And for me personally, I think that interpersonal skills are so important. And things like the Prince's Trust, things like the Scouts, the Cadets, the Duke of Edinburgh Awards, you know, all these things get young people out, pushing their comfort zone, building resilience, gaining confidence. It's skills for life. It absolutely is. And yes, academics are important, but, you know, so are interpersonal skills. So I think, you know, trying to give kids those opportunities, especially if they come from backgrounds where they might not have as many opportunities as other children, is vitally important.
And just reading your book, what's interesting, you didn't set out to be an astronaut. You went into the army, you went into flying helicopters, you became a test pilot, and then it was suggested to you that you did that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think if you'd have, you know, questioned children in the UK in the 1980s, I don't think actually many of them would have thought they could be astronauts, because we were watching Americans and Russians fly to space. And I was too. I was enjoying it. I watched the shuttle launches later on. I watched the Mir space station being built. But again, it seemed to be something that other nations were doing, and we could just look on in awe and wonder. And, you know, I chose my passion, which was aviation. You know, maybe if I'd have grown up in the US and thought, actually, one day that could be me, maybe it would have been different. For me, it was much more of a sort of iterative process and a more incremental route of getting there. But I think the main thing is to enjoy the journey, because, you know, even if you do set your sights on becoming an astronaut, which is fantastic to have dreams, it's fantastic to have goals and ambitions, but you've still got to enjoy the journey. You know, nobody gets picked to be an astronaut from school or from university. So you've got to think, what is it that you're going to do before you become an astronaut, and make sure it's something you're passionate about.
And what about your goals and ambitions? You knew this question was coming. Are you going back to space as an Easter astronaut, or is at least that your plan, to go back to space as an Easter astronaut?
There's certainly an ambition to get back to space, yes. And ESA is flying its European astronauts at a great rate. They always have had a really good track record, and we've seen Luca and Alex return to the space station. Tomo will fly next year on SpaceX, which will be exciting. And then Samantha, Andy, myself, and Matthias as well, our new class of 2009 who's joined us, Matthias. So yeah, ESA has a plan to fly us all back. And of course, the space station is a destination, but what's really exciting about the next 5 years is we're going to see the first humans go back to the moon after this break that we've had on SLS and Orion. So it's going to be really exciting to see ESA involved in that. And who knows, you know, maybe we'll see European astronauts in the early stages of those missions.
And that's a possibility for you. I mean, you can only have that at the back of your mind. You can't.
Yeah,
you can't.
I mean, the UK is obviously part of ESA, and ESA is part of the Artemis program. So, yeah, we're very much involved in that.
And when you go back, can I help with your playlist, please?
I'll come and give you a shout, Richard.
British ESA astronaut Tim Peake. And if you've got a story of what Tim Peake's mission has meant to you and the people you know, do submit your thoughts to the Inspired by Tim campaign on the UK Space Agency website. And there are apparently prizes. And Tim's book, Limitless, is pretty much everywhere. It's genuinely really good. Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to sound surprised there. It's really good. And we'll discuss it in just a sec. This is Space Boffins. We're in partnership with The Naked Scientists. You can find us on most social media. Do get in touch. You can also email info@boffinmedia.co.uk. I wanted to talk a bit more about the book, just in that it is really good. What's really good about
it... Yes, you sounded very surprised. No. Yet again.
But
was this a good book, or
was
an
a really
excellent
good
book, or was it better than normal,
<It's>
or more than you expected?
No, well, I always sound. People say I sound when I'm trying to give a compliment. Someone said the other day I sounded passive aggressive, and I really don't mean to.
That's very accurate. Yeah, I'm just aggressive, aggressive.
So anyway, no, it's a really good book. What's great about it? What's great about it is that actually 2/3 of it is not about Tim Peake's mission to the International Space Station. It is about his growing up, his going to Sandhurst, his posting in Northern Ireland during the Troubles in Northern Ireland, and then becoming a helicopter pilot.
I hadn't known
pilot.
That about Northern
exactly.
Ireland.
So that's all fascinating. What I loved about that interview, and also I think it's from the book, I think it's because he's processed a lot of the things that he was talking about, which is what we talked about in the interview, he's much more open. We're hearing a lot more. But previously I've asked him that question because I knew he wasn't in a good way after he came back from other people who were there at that moment. But he's never talked about that.
For me,
I thought that was fascinating.
It's how relaxed. Within a few minutes of listening to it for the first time, I thought, oh, gosh, he sounds different. He sounded relaxed and more open and free, I suppose. And maybe that's, you know, obviously through having time out from doing the very regimented, scripted, often, you know, do say this, don't say that type interviews, when you have to do press interviews, understandably. I think we got added Tim. I think I feel as though I got to hear him as having more of a personality.
No, I agree, absolutely. And I think it was fascinating hearing about the multiple failures as they were docking. Mm. I mean, we got a sense that something had gone quite wrong when we were doing the commentary.
Because you could see people's faces.
Well,
yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And senior mission controllers, their faces. Whereas all you get over the loops, you know, the mission control to the crew is this very calm, obviously. You know,
like,
they're all professionals.
Like ducks on water, the calm gliding on, or swans, the calm gliding on the surface, and then you look beneath the water and you see everybody's feet going.
Yeah, and it was interesting to, it was about, you know, the crew had to sort this problem out themselves, essentially. But we got no real sense of that. We could just see what was happening, and it was clear that the docking had to be aborted. And also, as I was saying, when he was came back to Earth and the medical problems he experienced within the first 48 hours.
I liked
hours.
His description. He said a roller coaster. He really genuinely, even just thinking about it, sounded like he was reliving the moment and obviously had a really great time. A moment that probably would have had most people throwing up in a corner.
You talk
somewhere.
To other people,
yeah.
And they find that, you know,
yes,
Soyuz,
they always
absolutely.
Say that's the even astronauts who've been into space multiple times just can't forget that landing.
No, absolutely. And we'll come back to this in the new year, because I also talked to a couple of people who've, you know, have been inspired by the mission. Because really, you know, if you were in the UK, I mean, if you were at school in the UK, he was really absolutely a superstar.
Kids went wild here,
absolutely,
didn't they?
Absolutely. Yeah. He's such a, you know, an A-list celebrity among, well, they were now adults of a certain age.
Which is amazing. I mean, because for places like America, they've had that for decades, because they've had so many, particularly post-shuttle, so many astronauts go into space. And you know, NASA, they're brilliant at their PR, and the astronauts there are so good at communicating their love of science or space or what have you, and encouraging kids to go on and do STEM subjects or aim high. I think Britain finally got a little taste of it, because we did have it with Helen Sharman, obviously, in the 80s, and that was amazing. But actually, we then had 20 years of that was sort of it. So there's a whole generation of children in the UK that have not had that role model.
But I think the name recognition is really interesting. You know, if you did a survey of name astronauts, I think, you know, Tim Peake would probably be number one, particularly anyone in their teens or early 20s.
Yes.
It wouldn't be Buzz Aldrin or any of the Apollo astronauts.
No, because that's ancient history for this generation.
But similarly,
now.
I think in America, you know, there's not much name recognition for most of the shuttle astronauts, with a few exceptions, maybe, you know. But, you know, Tim Peake, absolutely.
Chris Hadfield, they'll all know, and maybe Mike Massimino from
Big Bang Theory.
Yeah. And they'll know Karen Rubin. And obviously they'll know the most recent amazing women.
Maybe.
Oh, maybe. Do you think?
Maybe.
Oh, I think the ones that have just come back from the space station. Oh, you're sounding very cynical now, Richard.
Maybe.
I want the overexcited one now.
Just to say again, if you have got anything you know you could contribute, this Inspired by Tim campaign is quite cool. Have a look at the space agency website.
Well, one person that you may recall seeing a lot on TV screens in the UK during Tim Peake's launch and subsequent stay on the space station was Libby Jackson. She managed the education programme for Tim Peake's mission, and as a former flight director at ESA's Columbus Control Centre in Munich, she also knows what it's like to be in constant touch with the ISS, in that case for Europe's Columbus Laboratory. Well, a few years ago, she wrote the extremely popular book book, A Galaxy of Her Own, about women in space. And her latest book for young readers is Space Explorers, 25 Extraordinary Stories of Space Exploration. As its name suggests, it contains 25 chapters covering memorable tales ranging from the first astronauts to today, including one of them about Luca Parmitano's near drowning on a spacewalk, which you can hear the astronaut talking about himself in our October podcast, I think it was, celebrating 20 years of human presence on the ISS. But back to Libby and the reason for writing a second book.
It really, for me, is about sharing the history, the amazing stories of what's happened in human spaceflight right back from the beginning. And those were the stories that captured my imagination and led me into the space industry. It's really trying to tell the big adventures that go right back to the beginning, but also then take you all the way through up to the present day and what's happening on the International Space Station and so on. And by the time you get later in it, it was much easier to find stories that did reflect the diversity of the space sector today. And I hope it will inspire people from whatever their background, whatever they look like, wherever they're from, to see that the space sector is something they can come and get involved in.
What I like about the book are the stories, and you've honed in on, with like Vostok 2, on the rescue, which when I sort of read it, I thought, yeah, that's the really interesting bit about it. I mean, is that sort of what made your decision, was sort of like, okay, there's so much of space history, but which are the bits that I sort of think, oh yeah, that was a good bit, because that involved skiers and snow and cutting down trees before we could actually get to the cosmonauts?
Yes, I think to a young person, you sometimes have to go, this really did happen. There is so much excitement and so much drama. But for young people today, you sort of step in their shoes. They've had humans living and working in space their entire lives. Space is part of everyday life. In some ways, it's almost not exciting. And what I wanted to do was go and capture that excitement, that amazement, the drama, particularly in the early days, though the book really takes you right through. And it was those stories that were like, oh, wow. And for me, it was so important that the very first page in it says that, and I can read it out now, says, these stories are not creations of imagination, no matter how unbelievable they may at first seem. And they're all true, told just as they really happened. And that was, for me, the most important bit, because so much gets dramatised, and then you start going, what's real and what's not? And what I wanted to do was just portray the excitement and the drama
of reality.
Yes. And I think they landed in the middle of this snow-covered forest, and they had to, you know, were looking out for bears. And all that drama after the first spacewalk, I think it's amazing. And then you go through to Michael Foal and the crew on board Mir, who were having to look at the stars to work out which way their space station was pointing. They had to do that to get the fans going so they could breathe air, because the Mir space station was just in such trouble. You can't make these things up. You don't need to, because they're that fantastic and amazing. And I really want to share with young people these wonderful, wonderful stories.
I really liked the Sally Ride and Svetlana Zabiskaya. Yes. I think that's how you pronounce her surname.
No, it was a story that I discovered reading the biography of Sally Ride. And then you dig into it and you could, there's things from the translators, that the story in a nutshell, for those who don't know it, and I would be surprised how many do, if many do. Sally Ride, of course, was the first female American astronaut, but she wasn't the first woman in space. That was Valentina Tereshkova. She wasn't the second either. It was Svetlana Savitskaya. And the two of them had both gone through their missions and both had to deal with all kinds of rubbish, in my view, from the press, the sort of sexist comments. How are you going to deal with your hair? Are you scared? The kinds of questions they were getting that none of the men who they were flying with were getting. And they'd both gone through this and had both, you know, been into space and shown that absolutely men and women can both belong in space and both are equally capable. But after their missions, Sally had to go on a sort of tour around the world, publicity tour, as astronauts still do today. And part of this had seen her go to the International Astronomical Congress, the IAC, which is the big sort of space, world space conference that happens once a year. It still happens today. And the year post Sally's mission, this was happening in Hungary, in Budapest. So Sally had gone, but she was under strict instructions not to talk to anyone from Russia because there was a big diplomatic incident going on. I think a plane had been shot down. Some Americans died and the Russians was potentially somehow implicated in this. So she was like, you can't talk to any of the Russians, or I think the Soviets, I should say, at that time. So there she was at the conference, and there was a tap on her shoulder in sort of mingling network situation. She spins around and she sees Svetlana. And remembering all her orders, she said, oh, and she made her apologies and run off. But afterwards, as it says in the book, and when the story has been recounted by her, she felt very rude, but also wanted to talk more to Svetlana. These were the only two people who had gone through the same experiences as each other, you know, that time. But essentially, she ends up meeting Svetlana very covertly.
It makes it sound like a spy novel, doesn't it?
It's really the thing. There were cars. It was pouring rain. There were, you know, Sally, I think she really was worried she was ending up in a spy novel, and where was she going? And Sally and Svetlana ended up having just one evening together where they could talk and exchange gifts, and they you know, spent the evening as friends, discovering that they had gone through the same things, and it was the only time in their lives that they ever met. There's so many different stories in there about, it's not just about the antics that happen in space, it's about all these other stories too. And it was a delight to research them and then share them with the readers.
And one final thing I must mention, I really, really enjoyed the illustrations. Beautiful colour palette, slightly retro, but also sort of as they get further on, slightly modern as well. They're just gorgeous.
Leonard DuPont has done a marvellous job, and it was really a joy to work with him to bring them to life. But like everything in the book, my watchword has been accuracy. And there's artistic license and so on, but he was great to work with, and there's an illustration there, a sort of bird's eye view of Neil and Buzz on the moon, and you know the scene with the lunar module and the flag. And I remember having discussions going, the shadows aren't quite right. You know, we've got to get this right. We've got to get the physics right. We've got to get the sizes right so that you don't look at it and go, that feels wrong.
Yeah, there's enough conspiracy theories. Thank you very much. We don't want exactly. to contribute and to another one. Yeah.
Young readers might not see that, but I think it's so important for them to read something that is real and true and isn't made up. That attention to detail is there throughout, and he has brought some of those scenes to life in such a fabulous way. Yeah, it's a beautiful thing, and he really did a marvellous job. I'm very proud of it.
Libby Jackson and her book Space Explorers, 25 Extraordinary Stories of Space Exploration. And I realised on listening back to that interview that instead of Voskhod-2, I said Vostok. Too. So I do know I said that. don't shame me. Don't shame me. Interestingly, because you touched on in the Tim interview about the right stuff, Libby made that little comment about, you know, actually that she wanted to be really accurate and make these stories that were sort of factual and truth-based. That's something, particularly with the TV series The Right Stuff, that seems to have slightly divided some space communities, doesn't it, in terms of what actually happened and the need for drama, which means you do, if it's a dramatized version. I mean, I err towards it's got to be good drama as long as you don't make so completely inaccurate things about the space thing, like so maybe saying a different astronaut went there first or something.
No, I mean, I've at the risk of okay. I agree. I mean, I think the drama is more often more interesting, and I know a lot of space buffs are often into the hardware, and
I'm more into the people and the human stories. And I think the Right Stuff TV series...
Well, we've been enjoying it,
yeah,
haven't we?
Absolutely. I think it's great because those I've spoken to... I mean, I think we should get, actually, the author on of the autobiography on Alan Shepard, because he seems a particularly fascinating character. And obviously, it's not word for word. It's like The Crown. It's like the debate over The Crown, yeah. Isn't it? That, you know, it's not wholly accurate, but it essentially reflects the overall arc of the story, and you get the individual drama and a sense of their psyches. And talking to people who knew Alan Shepard, it seems they pretty much got it spot on.
I wonder if he did get his top off, though, every opportunity. Maybe that may be the director or the dramatising of, he's got quite a good physique, let's have him with his shirt off in every other scene.
That could be more. To be honest, I hadn't noticed that. Interesting you should pick up on that.
That's probably via Space Hipsters, actually. As soon as that was said, I thought, yeah, they're right.
I do love the human drama. And I think that's what, coming back to Tim Peake's interview, it's those human dramas that makes it all come alive. Yeah. And surely that's what human spaceflight's about. And that's what engages us. It's humans doing these things in space. And that's what's the most engaging, the most exciting.
Yeah, well, Libby's book would make a great Christmas present, as would our next book, which is called Unmasked: Science Behind Superheroes. It's written by six scientists at the University of Central Lancashire and covers a combination of science, including space science, in a really fun and accessible way for young adults and students. So it's a higher level because it does involve all the explanations of the physics and the maths in some cases, but through cartoon characters and relating to a lot of very recognisable Marvel characters in particular, shall we say. A lot of the cartoons are based on the authors themselves and their particular speciality. And so I spoke to one of the authors, solar physicist Professor Robert Walsh, and began by discussing with him how they came up with the idea in the first place.
At the University of Central Lancashire, we do have quite a number of, you know, academics, particularly young lecturers, who really enjoy telling other people about the science that they're involved with. And as you do as academics, you're sitting around one day before COVID, of course, and we talked to one another and we thought, actually, we're all sort of interested in these aspects of, you know, superheroes and science fiction. In fact, some of the people involved do actually go to things like cosplay and dress up as the various characters from a whole range of different, you know, superhero and Doctor Who and Star Trek and things like that. I said, well, is there any way we could use our public engagement abilities, the fact we want to communicate our science, but do it through the medium of these sort of superheroes? So we approached the university. They gave us some sort of seed corn funds to work with our publishing wing, UCLan Publishing, and they encouraged us to work with actually our students. So we have had undergraduate students who are on the publishing course to help us to edit the materials we put together. We got a student to do a lot of the illustration, particularly those on the cover of the book. And we pulled it together as a chapter per science discipline. And, you know, something which maybe we couldn't have done each of us. But when we came together like a super team, like the Avengers working together to reach a goal, we managed to pull the book off.
Do you know what? That's so funny because I was going to be quite flippant and say, did you get this idea for this book because you wanted to see what you all looked like in Lycra? But basically the answer to that was yes.
Yes.
We did. And in fact, many of you already knew.
Yeah. Like I'm the only one that hasn't really. But, you know, with my character, they're very keen to try and get me dressed up like the characters that they've drawn us as.
Let's just go into what you do look like in Lycra. Okay, I've got your chapter open here, and obviously, as befits your work as a professor of solar physics, you've got a sun in the middle of your breastplate armor. You've got a traditional superheroes. You know, there was usually a cape, but we all know how dangerous they can be.
They can, yes.
You've got sort of blue lycra, and you're firing sort of solar flame balls from your hands. You've got epaulets, but you've got red groovy goggle glasses, sort of replicating your in a much more comic book form your normal glasses.
That's
which
true,
aren't
yeah.
obviously red glass, but you're green.
Yes,
why did you want to be green?
I suppose there's a maybe could be a couple of reasons. as you can probably hear, I'm from Ireland, from Northern Ireland. There's a greenness for being Irish. But probably also the fact that the chapter is about alien superheroes. You know, what's it like, you know, in regard of thinking about aliens existing, if they are? And I suppose the initial reaction of people to that is, oh, it must be somebody who's green, because that's the sort of colour we sort of associate with these little green men or women that could exist out there.
I never put that together. It didn't dawn on me that, and it should have done. Having just recently written an article on the psychology of alien belief, effectively little green men, for BBC Science Focus magazine. Now, your chapter is on the Drake equation. And I mean, apart from, you know, you do the birth of stars and things, but you really go into detail. I actually thought that was quite clever, because I think we tend to think of the Drake equation of, oh, well, it's an equation for working out the number of potential alien civilizations without really knowing all the component parts of that.
Yeah, the Drake equation was put together by Frank Drake. Really wasn't just to get a number, you know, not just to get an idea of an estimate, I suppose, of the number of intelligent civilizations that could exist in the Milky Way, but rather an opportunity to go through that thought process of saying, okay, what elements do you need to have in place for an intelligent civilization to exist out there, be in the same time frame that we are here, and also that would want to communicate with us. So we approached it in a way of trying to break it down into those component parts and look at the science behind each of them, and then sort of bring it all back together to see what the final sort of solution actually is. Some of those elements are very challenging within the Drake equation, what we are estimating at this moment in time for compared to what we think we scientifically know. And there are still many known unknowns in the Drake equation. But it does give us a way of thinking, well, if life is out there, you know, what does it need to exist? What does it need to flourish? And what does it need to try and be speaking to us?
Yeah. And I mean, obviously, each chapter covers, as you said, a different aspect of it. And in fact, you do cover psychology for superheroes, engineering, super enhancements, artificial intelligence. But space does prop up again, specifically, I noticed, in the mathematics chapter.
In the maths chapter in particular, you're looking at things about relativity and things like that. What happens if you travel, you know, really fast and things like that? There's aspects of just the basic aspects of weightlessness when you go into space, your mass, the effect of gravity and how that can be worked out. Remember, this is a book to try and get people the basics of science across in that way. When you look at the psychology side of things, I suppose we looked at it not just with the psychology of a super brain, what does a superhero's brain look like, but also things like teamwork, looking at what the NASA astronauts, for example, are doing on the International Space Station, how they sort of interact with each other, and then how superhero teams could work together. You just need to look at Captain America and Iron Man in their Civil War to see how a team super individuals can disintegrate really rapidly if they're strong views on either side. So we try to build into the superhero genre some real background science that can come out and that can actually help people think, oh yeah, like I can understand a bit more about science, but actually I'm just using superheroes to get to it.
Actually, the psychology is really interesting with the some of the people that are more of the characters, say like Elon Musk, for instance, in terms of the independent space industry, particularly when he's Elon Musk. I mean, the name itself is magnificent.
It is,
that could be a comic book character, but he could also so easily be the hero or the baddie, depending on which way you write him, really.
You could fall either way on that. Very much so.
And he's opinionated too, because you want the best superheroes, I think, are the ones who've got a personality.
Yeah, a very strong
and
conviction.
Who are flawed, are geniuses but flawed, or, you know, there's something in them that's not vanilla.
Absolutely. But you have to be a very strong character to be like an Elon Musk or Tony Stark or Lex Luthor, depending on what side of the fence you want to sit on.
Robert Walsh, one of the authors of Unmasked, Science Behind Superheroes, published by the University of Central Lancashire, supported by STFC. It's going to be placed in all UK libraries as well, but you can order it from most bookstores, as with Libby's book, and online, including for this one, www.unmaskedscience.com, which features online games and science lessons as well, based on the UK curriculum, as well as experiments based around superheroes. So if in the new year you've got a bit of homeschooling for any potential lockdown reasons, then there's the place to go. And you'll be pleased to hear that the scientists have a follow-up book planned, considering what we discussed about Elon Musk, that will concentrate on supervillains next time. So I'm looking forward to that.
I told you it was a good one.
Oh, yeah, all right, yes. It's
was it good or good?
It's
great.
It's of the usual high space boffin standard. Thank you very much.
Thanks again to the UK Space Agency for supporting the podcast and the Naked Scientists for hosting. We'll be back next year with more on the return to the moon. Thanks for your support. Thanks for listening.